you know, in terms of our big clients. So CPS is our biggest client with 15.2%. And then you have the URF with 5.8%. Then you have the Compensation Commission at 1. And then Compensation Commission Fund at 1.6. And you've got the AITF at 0.9. And then other small clients at 1.5. In total, our assets under management as of the 31st of March are equal to 1.6 trillion. I'll let my colleague go through the list.
Thanks, Mashapo. Thanks, Chair. The next slide that you see there is the asset classes in which the CIC invests. And this allocation is determined by the clients, not ourselves. They run their asset and liability study. From there, they create what is known as strategic asset allocation, which in simple terms simply a proxy for their long-term liabilities, and they pass on the mandate to us for implementation. The current asset classes that we invest in, we have listed investment in the domestic market, which accounts for almost 70% of our assets under management. These monies are invested in listed equities, which are in-house managed, as well as externally managed by external managers in order to create extra return. We have a large fixed income portfolio as well as large component of cash and money market so that the fund can meet its short-term liquidity needs and long-term. And then we also have unlisted investment in the domestic space. We focus on private equity. In developmental investment, we have real estate as well as small and medium enterprises. And that accounts for almost 20% of our assets under management. And then there is non-domestic assets, mainly the key driver there being diversification outside of the country. We are invested there in global equities, global bonds, and then we have an Africa allocation of 5% as part of our efforts to drive regional integration. The non-domestic assets account for almost 10% of assets under management. The next slide shows you the history or the evolution of our strategic asset allocation over time, how the mandates of our clients have changed over time, from way back when the PIC was only investing in bonds, pre-1992, and then by 1994, what you see is a significant change in asset allocation resulting from the amalgamation of all TBVC state pension funds together with government, national government at that time, to form what is known as the government employees pension fund. That happened in 1994, and then asset and liability modeling was done, which pointed towards a much more diversified portfolio. You will see that from 1997, you see broader asset classes from fixed income, equities, as well as bonds. And that trend has, you know, been the same as evolved over time. By 2010, the clients, GPF in particular, did another ALM study that pointed towards diversification in non-domestic assets for the first time. And the previous slide, as I said, 10% of the allocation in non-domestic assets, that happened in 2010 when we got the first mandate to go offshore. And we've been implementing that until now. In what sense how we invest, Sheraton, we have a number of strategies that we follow in order to generate returns for our clients in line with their mandate. First is what we call alpha strategies. These are active management. Most of the active management is done outside of the PIC. We've allocated monies to active managers to be able to produce for us excess returns over the benchmark. Internally, we run what are called beta strategies. These are passive strategies where we don't take active risk against given benchmarks. We replicate the benchmarks in terms of return and characteristics there. And then we also have unlisted investment. Both beta and alpha are happening in the listed space, and then we have unlisted strategies as well as real estate. In the unlisted space, we have In particular, we have developmental investments, which are informed by both the new growth path as well as now the NDP, where we invest in assets that have a huge social impact in terms of job creation and poverty alleviation. And we also have real estate, we have unlisted debt in the unlisted space. Those are quite development, and we all know that real estate is very developmental in nature. What you see there, Chair, on page 10 is asset under management, how much we've grown. This is, to a large extent, a reflection of the success of our investment strategy. You will notice that from 2003 to date, the growth is actually steeper. The reason why I'm mentioning that is because from 2003 onwards, we started working on corporatizing the PIC. Before 2004, the PIC used to be called Public Investment Commissioners. It was managed by commissioners. It didn't have its own staff. All staff were seconded from National Treasury, and there was no CEO then. And most importantly, it was difficult to manage a Congress mandate under that regulatory environment. And so we decided to corporatize the PIC, to transform it into a modern asset management so that it can have its own staff, it can be have its own board of directors and CEO. That happened in 2004 through the PIC Act. And then from then we reorganized, put in a new IT platform, put in a robust investment process and risk management that is reflected in us producing compound annual growth returns of in excess of 16% over the period. If you plot the assets under management against GDP over from 1995, you will see a good trend there that the assets under management grow when the economy grows. We are exposed to the economy. And the rule of thumb, from what we can measure, is that the growth in our assets under management is almost 5 times the growth of the GDP. So we require strong economic growth for assets to increase. It's very important for assets to grow, because then the clients will be able to meet their liabilities and their due. They'll be able to pay pensions, they'll be able to make pensioners will be able to enjoy increases in pensions and so on. All of that depends on how well assets are growing. Now we are changing the equation a little bit to say, is it possible for us to influence the economy through our investments in a way we select investments? And we think we can do that. Instead of depending on the economy for growth, we must invest smartly in such a way that to grow the economy so that the assets can grow, in that way creating a virtuous cycle. That's what we're working on. The investment strategy of the PIC is based on this observation here. Most importantly, to put it in context, our responsibility, if you take our assets under management and divide it by the GDP, you will see that we are almost 33% of our GDP, which means we have significant influence in the economy, and it's a huge responsibility for us to now utilize the assets in order to influence the economy positively. This is how we are doing it. We're creating the virtuous cycle that I'm talking about. We want to invest in economy, identify those factors that are catalysts for economic growth. If the economy grows, we'll get returns. If we get good returns and growth, assets under management will grow. And then we'll reinvest in the economy in that way, thus creating this virtuous cycle that I'm talking about. If you look at the success of the past, how we did it, the slide that I showed you on the growth in assets under management in excess of 16%, we were adopting certain strategies where we were just responding to client mandate and investment parameters. The strategy was benchmark driven with very low focus on economic growth stimulation. Just investing in the DSC, just investing in bonds, and a little bit of manifest DC funding with an allocation of 5%. That has been successful, I must say, because we are able to generate those returns over the last 3 years. Now we are changing the approach. And the approach is one that says we are going to be active participants in the economy through developmental investments, as well as using the JSC to also stimulate growth. The JSC, if you decompose the JSC itself, you see that there are quite a number of counters that are exposed to important parts of the economy, that are exposed to all elements of NGDP, or the new growth path, as well as the new developmental plan. And our aim here is to try and forge strategic relationship with such companies so that together we are able to invest heavily in areas that will catalyze, economic growth. And to do that, we have decomposed South Africa's GDP to try to identify, you know, which areas we should focus on as we invest. What you see there is a usual equation of GDP that says government, consumption, investment, exports, less imports. And we've plotted, we've just taken the top five in each category. And you will see that, especially if you can focus on imports, you will see that crude oil takes away quite a bit from the economy. We're talking here 15.8, or in 2012, we spent almost 131 billion rands on oil imports. Motor vehicle parts quite heavy at 64 billion. Radio communication, etc. Motor vehicle parts and petroleum products. And our thoughts are that we should find a way of reducing imports somehow, you know. Invest in those assets that will be able to, over time, minimize the amount of crude oil that we import. Vehicle parts, we will find a way of setting up manufacturing facilities here so that we can minimize imports. On the export side, for example, if you look at partner, the PGS, we're exporting quite a bit, and in most cases we're exporting raw material as opposed to plants, and that's where the beneficiation becomes very critical to ensure that we at least extract additional value out of the exports. So, in terms of positioning our strategy, we'll be focusing on these areas and looking for partners that will be able to invest alongside ourselves in order to deal with the growth. The next slide really is an explanation of explanation of the previous chart on how we do it. In Japan, for example, in oil and gas, you have seen that it's the largest import bill. You know, we have partners that we've identified, the Department of Energy, Minerals, and so on, that we need to partner with, and in entities and developmental finance institutions, Petro SA, BDSA, IDC, and so on, and in the private sector, JSC, limited company that are paying in the oil and gas. Those should be our partners in, you know, an effort to try and cap the amounts of imports in oil. Manufacturing beneficiation, we're looking for partners as well. We've identified quite a few that will be able to work with us. Financial services, national treasury is very key there. And we have USA again, and JSC listed banks. Economic infrastructure, we have quite a number of big players that are playing in the construction space and so on. I think across all these sectors, we would like to build our forward relationship and build what we call national champions. in these sectors to be able to grow the economy much better. This also furthermore explains our investment approach. If you plot on the x-axis to the right, you're looking for financial return. To the left, no financial return. On the y-axis, if you go up, you're looking for social and economic impact and environmental impact. And then if you go down, you're just looking for returns to a large extent. You will see that most of JSC companies are sitting in the lower quadrant on the right. It's all about returns and so on. And we are trying to push that into the first quadrant where you get both returns as well as social impact. That's where we want to play with developmental investments. And the structure really of developmental investments on the next page, we decompose it into a number of pillars here, the developmental investments, and these are in line with, to a large extent, the growth path, as well as the national development plan. You see economic infrastructure, where the focus will be on roads, rail, transport, and so on. Social infrastructure, dealing with affordable housing, health, education, and so on. Priority sectors, agriculture and agro-processing, manufacturing, beneficiation, tourism, Dinamani, that's small and medium enterprises, which will take advantage of opportunities that are created by other pillars. And we're going to play a very important role in environmental sustainability as well as in the renewable space, renewable energy, clean technology, green building, sustainable environment, and so on. And then on the private entity side, here we are going to focus on transformation, socio-economic transformation, in particular broad-based DE, where we fund capital expansion for growth, and also DE in those areas. And the real estate, we are a player there as well. And as I said, this area is quite developmental in nature. We can create jobs in this area. So we have this model that we quite direct. That is our mantra there, which stands for developmental investing for radical economic transformation. This is the menu. The next slide shows you the NDP. Most importantly, developmental investment, as I've highlighted in previous slides, the new growth path focus, as well as the 2020-2030 vision, which is a national development plan. We see national development plan as an investment strategy and not as a policy. Chair, we have done quite a bit so far. The next slide will show you what we have been doing in the NDP space as well as NDP, aligning KIC activities to be a very important player in NDP as well as in NGP. On the employment, economy and employment side, you will see that we have invested heavily in the priority sector pillar with an allocation of almost 3 billion for that. And currently, we've almost invested 1 billion into agriculture, agro-processing, and mining beneficiation. Private equity, 5 billion. 2.2 billion is already invested. In fact, we are almost fully invested in that space. We have 1.5 billion that we put in there already. You see that all of these are in line with the new growth path as well as traditional development plan. And the achievements are on the in the next column there that shows that in the renewable space already, we have been able to create jobs to an extent of 24,000 jobs through this activity, and almost about 13,000 of these jobs are the local communities. In the SME space, we've created in excess of 10,000 jobs, priority sector, 4,000, and so on. And this is the first round of allocation that we are doing. We'll raise additional cash over time because we have almost 5% of assets under management I think at this point we are almost 25% invested. So we still have a lot of scope to be able to invest more in this job creation and social impact activities. In the infrastructure space, you will see that we are very much a significant participant. We have an exposure to that area, for example, in Trinity Toll, and quite a number of other economic infrastructure others. 3.8 billion already invested so far. In the sustainable and the environmental pillar, we have committed 5 billion. But since inception, including other money that we've invested before, we are sitting at about 8.3 billion in the renewable space. We are a very significant player there, you know. And in the social infrastructure, 5 billion have been committed. You know, we have we are about to complete a hospital in Soshanguve. There's one in Mpumalanga that is near completion. We've done quite a bit of investment in agriculture, just veggies, where we've allowed communities to participate in the agricultural space. And we continue to double our efforts so that we are able to create this much needed jobs, and most importantly, stimulating economic growth as part of our bigger strategy. So, Chair, these are the alignments in terms of regional integration. We have also forged very important partnerships with key players. For example, in the continent, we have a relationship with Development Bank, African Development Bank. We have relationship with the ECOWAS Bank called EBIT in the West. In the East, we have relationship with PTA Bank. Locally, we are in partnership with IDC, DBSA, very important partnership to be able to deliver much-needed jobs. DBSA in particular focusing on local government and municipality. So we are quite active. We'll allocate a significant amount of money into their program so that we are able to expedite or improve service delivery. On education, Chair, as we said, we have 5 billion that is earmarked for affordable housing. We are going to be a very key player in education infrastructure, in particular student accommodation. We are looking at healthcare, in the renovation of our public hospitals and so on, in partnership with our DFIs. We are working hard at this point with allocated boundaries to an extent of 19,200 to learners to further their education as part of our efforts there. In healthcare, as I said, we have a hospital that we are about to complete. And Chair, I think in the nutshell, this PIC's activity insofar as aligning our processes or investment strategy with the national development plan. And we will work tirelessly, double our efforts, so that we are able to create the better cycle that I spoke about in partnership with all the players in the listed as well as the listed space. Thank you.
The other apology I must send is from Dias Pandroni's opposition. Welcome, Deputy Minister, sir. Your wish to the members? Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the presentation. It was very interesting. Just got a couple of questions. My first question is about Elias Masilela. I was just wondering what happened to him. You know, he went through quickly and, you know, we didn't hear anything about it, so I'd be interested to know why did he go and where did he go. Then, on the issue of shareholder activism, now, you obviously are a big investor and you invest in many companies. I want to know what it is that you do in terms of shareholder activism, you know, in terms of corporate governance, etc., ensuring that the companies that you invest in do keep themselves as tidy as possible. And I think that that possibly could fit under one of the MPP chapters, which is a fighting corruption one, because I think that there can be some elements of difficulty within corporate governance in companies. Then I want to ask about a specific investment. When I was in finance committee a couple of years ago, there was the issue of AfriSam that came up, and it was a very troubled investment, it seemed. And I suppose that then an answer to the next question about the investment philosophy. Now, I can see that you're investing in various states, including, for example, under the heading inclusive rural economy, building 100-bed private hospital in Shanghai, etc. Now, do returns matter? Now, obviously, if you are taking a specific philosophy to say, well, you know, we want to invest in a certain way, and we don't specifically have all of our attention on returns, you know, where's the trade-off? Is there one? Because you speak about radical transformation, you know, investing for radical transformation. I'm not sure what that means. Because I get it that this is governance, well, it's pretty good money, actually, all of it. If you're investing on behalf of government, for example, the government employee pension fund, etc., and if something goes horribly wrong, government underwrites it anyway, so the people will hold the can at the end of the day. So I'm just wondering whether your investment philosophy is shifting, and if so, are you considering the risks associated with it? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm more or less on the same page as my colleague. Thank you for the very thorough and detailed presentation. The first issue that I would like to address is the enormous growth that you have. Am I correct to say that in a couple of years ago, I haven't got all the details here, but about 200 billion, and that is now currently your asset base is 1.6 billion, which is tremendous growth. And you indicated that your growth is 5 times the growth of GDP. And then, of course, the economy impacts on your investments, and you would like to stimulate growth. But I think my colleagues alluded to the fact that we have to, also there's some risk in terms of maximum returns. We know that investors are looking for returns and are not that socially inclined. We're confident here on your development of investment projects that you would like to stimulate growth. But can I then just say with regards to factors pivoting investment, which are, you know, mostly items of sometimes or wrong, in my opinion, with regards to as the impact of property, dilute the rights of property owners, some remarks from ministers in this regard, that impacts on growth and investment. And will you be able also to perhaps make presentations to the budget office if we have to investigate what enables growth in the country? Because if you go into this line of investing to stimulate growth in the country, surely you will be having a vested interest to stimulate growth. That would be my question, whether you'd be also making your interest with regards to what's needed to enhance growth in the country. I have a schedule that, with regards to the, and you say you work on the mandate of your funds, and that's your bigger funds, the GEPF. I have a schedule in terms of investments, also a category of other. And they say the fund performance in this regard is 9.42% on return, and that was in 2013. The benchmark performance is 21%, and then performance against the benchmark gives you minus 11%. The other includes Isabaya project. Isabaya, is that correct? Excuse me.
Fine.
Yes, the other category from G investment. They have asset classes, cash and money, domestic minimal bonds, domestic inflation, domestic property, and then they have a category of other which underperform. Are you aware of the category and does it include the Isabaya investments?
Thank you, Chair. First of all, let me welcome the presentation. I really do think that it is certainly step in the right direction. I am more encouraged by the new approach, and of course, you know, if you look at the South African reality, is that if you are dependent on the economy,
if you are not going to be playing an active part in your investment strategy, you are going to have the negative knock-on effect if you are going to be passive. And I think it is an active approach, moving away from the passive approach. I think it must be encouraged, and I'm very happy with that, especially because PIC has a lot of, obviously it's not your money, it's a pensioner's money, member money, but it's important that it's for your own good as well, that we use this leverage on these economies of scale to fast track economic growth in this country. But there is a question probably related to my previous colleagues, and that is, one is just wondering, how are you balancing the member expectations? And obviously any member who is with a member of the DEPF or UIF or whatever, all the other entities, obviously at the end of the day they expect a return on their investment. How do we balance that with the risk that we may be exposed to as a result of this active investment strategy? Have we really done an assessment, a risk assessment on how is our new strategy? What are the risks associated with our new investment strategy? Because I tell you what, I know for a fact, obviously I need you to confirm before I can say I know for a fact. I don't know how you have invested, for example, whether you did invest in the ETOL. And one would have thought that some due diligence before one goes into that kind of investment is done. And that relates to corporate governance issues. Are these people the way you are investing? Have they gone through the procedure? Have they gone through the public participation that was required? And all those things. The act in itself is not wrong. It's the processes that are causing as a major risk factor. And I think I want you to speak more on the process issues of corporate governance. And because I think, to me, the process issues are a major challenge. Because it's not, even with the ETOL saga, and probably you will help us with, I personally don't know what is your risk exposure in the ETOLs, for example. But I'm saying the act itself wasn't wrong, but if there was thought of, let's make sure that we follow all the necessary processes and so forth, and by the time we invest, then we know that we are minimizing the risk as much as possible. The other thing that I also wanted to share the light on is that does the GEPF as the major contributor stakeholder have a say on this new investment strategy? The reason why I am saying so is because I would imagine that they would, if they are putting their money there, they would obviously be very keen at knowing how are you performing and so forth. And finally, I wanted to know how has the contracting, the economy, which has been contracted, impacted on you? If you can give us the figures, specific figures on that, because we also want you to see the extent to which our public entities are impacted upon by what is currently happening, so that we may also offer some guidance and probably see as well how best we could be supporting you in whatever you are doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, I need to make a precursor that started by ignorance. And I'm not so clever, and some of the things I'm not very clever, that's for number one. Two, I'm a politician and I want to pretend that I'm an investor. So I'm going to try to speak like an investor. So for a change, I might say the confusing things. First, let me envy you for being an investor. Because one of the basic things that any investor wants to do is take a risk. And when you take a risk on behalf of clients, airlines is a benefactor. It wants to maximize returns. So they expect you to take a risk to maximize their returns, and sometimes you have a situation where things go right or they go wrong. So you move from an assumption that the strategy that you put in place is the best. But your strategy is not operated outside a global environment, right? It's within certain physicals that you find yourself in. So that's why I'm saying as an investor, I envy you. To really appreciate the fact that you moved towards corporate, because if you operate in a corporate environment, you basically find yourself in an environment where it is competing with way. In the context of the South African economy, it's a developmental stage. You need to have all the agendas. A developmental program, an investment program that needs to maximize returns. So these are very contradictory interests at the same time. And you have to juxtapose between the two. So you need to have more to be able to distribute. It's a very complex environment. And I know one of my colleagues. Is he gone? Are you there? You won't agree with this one. No? Yeah. Now, you decide on a very good principle of diversification. But I take an issue if you only invest 10% in global bonds. You're minimizing the risk. It's like if afraid to take the risk, I would have appreciated if you live on more than just 10%. I don't know what other companies does in terms of it and how you've seen their benefits when they've done more than that. So there's a benchmarking in active risk taking to me looks very limited. I'm not judgmental. I'm trying to be I pretend to be an investor. I'm not one. I'm not like that. So I'm trying to make sense of the things that I put on the table. Now, I wish, if you measure between returns and development, we can strike balance. I don't know how. I said I can't do that. But if you can find a way that in the radical transformation agenda, we balance between returns and developmental programs that we have put in place. So, also in terms of the fund performance, it's very easy to say the benchmark was 20% and your performance was 9%, but not juxtapose it with the global economy as it stands. It can't be in isolation. It can't be. There were such factors that influences what will impact the growth, right? We might not agree, but we need to talk about that. We need to table here. People should understand those conditions that leads to... You benchmark, everybody benchmark. That's the issue. You want to reach that level. But certain factors prohibit and inhibit. And one of the things I'm interested in is that you should say that the African Development Bank invested in this regard. I think we're still having very steep discussions with them to focus on the sub-Saharan Africa in terms of the investment, because in the recent past they are interested in being to the north, the west, you know. They've always seen South Africa as a, you know, developed state that does not need intervention. So it's one of the things that you... Now, here is the top five that you want to look at, and one of them is the petroleum industry. Now, fortunately, I said I'm not intelligent, remember, my husband works for petroleum estate. And also, there's sometimes some bedroom discussions, you know, I said, you guys, you want to invest in exploration, you get nothing. You pump this up, there's nothing that happens to avoid that comes from it, you know. And then he gives me some intelligent explanation about this, and then because I'm not so schooled, I don't understand. But I say, okay, fine, let me understand, because many research companies, and every peak, would be investing a lot in exploration. But I want to measure it with precision. I want this figure, and I'm looking forward to that, but I want us to really make us understand that you're as an investor in this challenge, this huge challenge, you need to be have a development approach, the thing that you need to do. So there's some kind of bold decisions that you're taking. And yet, deadlines, you know, they have deadlines, yes.
You are deadlines. The site wants to tell and then they feed it. It's hee-hee-ha, and then it's as if you are the only investor anyway. So it makes sense, Jay. I don't know. Maybe I made sense, but there's some of the things I had on my plate. Don't say about me within the township, you know.
No, I think that's fine. David, very quickly, we run out of time. I think the members will also think about this. We need some sort of, not because somebody's spoken actually, because she hasn't spoken before. I mean, now they're going to move that issue. But there is something the committee needs to apply to, mind you, which is a ceiling. The members, in their first thing, was at least, maybe 7 or 8 or something like that. But I'm cool. If people want to have 10 minutes or 15 minutes, I think there must be some rules. The only reservation I would have is that it would mean that we have to roll into the house at 2 o'clock. We can sit from 5 to 2, provided people open their lunch. But I must say, the input that I've made this morning, the quality of input, is very good. The chair should be given some latitude, use some rules, but at the same time, you know, have some latitude. I'm not complaining about anybody speaking beyond the time that they should. It just occurred to me because I have so much to say. I'm in trouble. What I think I'll do is, if I'm thinking for what is quite well away in the pizza, needless to say, for the DH, that's the usual paucity of death. So, one don't stand that. But I will consult with some of you outside. I like some of the questions I asked. I don't fully understand the implications. But I do want to, I should have done this as a way of introduction. I'm coming back to you. You're done, I was just teasing, please. I'm going to respond. I hear you.
Thank you. I was just going to confirm. Thank you, Chief.
No, okay. Shivam, we don't want, but I just want to alert members also. What are we actually doing here? Is getting a feel for what the issues are that the entity that fall within the portfolio of national trading deal with, right? But we are also beginning to now think about how we're going to engage with you over this term. You know, we appear from the secretaries of the committee, and from those who've been here before, the ones that this committee just cannot manage, unlike other committees, to engage vigorously with each of the entities that fall through the portfolio. If you look at the tax bills that are now looming, and we'll get the first reading on it tomorrow, we have got a huge agenda. So one of the things you must also think about is how you want to engage with the committee. Having said that, will members also apply their minds to that and pose appropriate questions that stick out to the extent you think you get some of them to your disposal? Okay, Shivambu, and then Dennis, and then George. I was just being facetious.
Thanks, Chair. I want to speak about the other thing, not what kind of thing. The I want to explain to me that flat talk in terms of the 2.7% in terms of, is that the PIC's control of the Rostov, the DG, and the other. Can you please explain to me that they took on, 7% on slide 12. And on slide 20, the mineral beneficiation, what exactly are you doing there? Wait, what is happening? Three, I want you to explain to me the PIC's investments with a guy called Garcia Lawrence. The Nigerian guy who is involved in crude oil and proteins. What is the reason behind that investment and the relationship with the president of the ANC? And yeah, whether there has been some sense of relationship with regard to that. Then, lastly, I want to, like this book on the next issue on the screen now, you correctly spoke about the possibility of import substitution, build capacity locally to produce goods and services that might be of use to the economy. And then, what is creative relationship to the industrial policy action plan? Well, how do you find expression within the whole DTI program and everything else? I know I see emphasizing NDP and NDP. What is your relationship with the Industrial Policy Action Plan in terms of building capacity for industrial expansion? So those are the conflict, more understandable questions that I was going to ask, not what I was doing.
Thank you, Chair. So your approach to enhance growth is a new approach to the more risk of the thing. Do you also consider the contingency reserve within the GPF as one of your biggest, as your biggest investment? And we know that the contingency reserve needs to be done every 3 years. The last one I believe was done in 2010. And at that point in time, it's either 5% of the percentage that needs to be a contingency reserve that they achieve, or I think the other number that I have is 18.64%. What would the current contingency reserve be, and what would the impact be in terms of risking the investment of the GPF into a more social compact investment part?
Thank you. I think a general thing is that you see one issue emerging in the world, and the Parliament can't ignore that. It's sort of principle that in the last few years, these things have become very controversial in the public domain. In two years, the way that I know it, I wanted to see me observing what's going on, because I was going to spend years here, and I didn't think I would have to die at the moment. But now that I'm here, obviously my job is to change and monitor that. But there have been a series of what I've seen in the public domain, controversial decisions you take about where you invest. And this money, after all, belongs to those who belong to act there in the past. So I think, instead of asking each specific question, you know what the public domain is. You can respond to all those allegations. This is Parliament. Many of those allegations may be suspect, may be wild, but it's your opportunity now to clear the air. Say, look, these are all what we did. So instead of asking you each case, I think just deal with cases that you know are in the public. Secondly, in relation to the city elections, you often don't seem to have a very clear set of criteria, at least in the public domain, to make clearer to us. Maybe you need to engage in some sort of advert or an interview or whatever it is appropriate for you to do to clarify that there are a set of objective criteria or a policy framework within which you decide where you might invest. And if you are finding the right balance of life between the need to grow your responsibility to those on whose behalf you act, money to give. So I think I'll leave it there, and in the third set of areas I'm interested in, the members will come back to you and say, well, you could answer some specific questions. How often have you appeared before the scrutiny in the Fox and the Parliament? What do you think should be the case in the first term of Parliament? See, we are moving towards sometime in the middle of August, by the end of August, I think, towards evolving an overall strategy for the 5-year term. A strategy is needed in Parliament, which is a plan and a program. And for programs, it's very hard to say. The major part of the strategy should be clear on the following day. Suppose, Mr. Minister, tomorrow, the medium-term framework will be conducted by the Parliament Commission. So all committees in Parliament will look at that and also shape our program. But for now, until December, we need to have a program. But we also have to evolve a program for the next 4.5 years. In that regard, we have to decide how often we will see you and about what. So we, in what we call it, for want of a better term, understand the landscape or understanding the terrain, faith of the collective. We need to know all parties that fall under our portfolio so as we better understand what binds these different entities, what should be our approach to them over the next 4.5 years. What I said earlier is that everybody who is familiar with this situation will be impossible to engage with all the entities together. But we are heading towards there, and there's no conclusion yet. We need to let all the relations that at least once a year you have to and not even one of our years more longer than a bit of way. So this is just like beginning of people who you are, what you do. We sort of know to the media. But this is like formal engagement. Do you mind have ideas on that?
Thank you, Chair. I intend to answer some of the questions in my morning experience for consideration. First one regarding the FTE of the PIC. Mr. Mafilela made a decision to leave the employment of the PIC. Exactly the terms and conditions of his departure, those were engagements he did with the shareholder as the person that appointed him. Then one question related to how do we decide how is 10% in global markets processing that is governed by our mandate, the Turing system assesses in terms of their risk profile, how much risk they appropriately take, taking into consideration their liability exposure. So that is given to us in the mandate before we decide. In the engagement of deciding how much they're going to take globally outside, they do consult the National Treasury and their underwriters of their liability. Then the question relating to the 32.7% of GDP, what it literally means is that when you look at the assets under management of the PIC in compared to the GDP, that's the portion it is. So if you look at if GDP is 100, we are 30. So that's the correlation to pick up that the magnitude of asset under management, how much it equates to when you refer it to GDP. Then I'll get my more famous friend, Dr. Dan, to answer some of the questions. Thank you.
Okay, Chair, let me start by thanking the committee members for very good questions. A number of them which will probably also reshape our strategy. These are very wonderful indeed. I think on the issue of shareholder activism and corporate governance, in particular NDP and fighting corruption, we have policies so far. I mean, we have our own governance policy. We are signatory to the UN Global Compact. We incorporate environmental, social, and governance issues in every investment that we do. But the most important thing is that we keep learning and refining as and when they come out. You know, we are not perfect. From time to time, our policies are not strong enough to deal with, you know, new things, if I were to put it. But as soon as that comes out, we refine our policies so that we can deal with it. So in aligning with NDP and most importantly, you know, dealing with the behavior that we've seen in some of the sectors of the JSU, whether it's construction or whatever, you know, we are tightening on our policies so that we can make sure that such things don't happen, you know, uncompetitive behavior, etc., you know. Even for that as far as AFRISAM is concerned, I think what I can report on, most importantly, AFRISAM is an important player in the economy. You know, if you look at the size of the market share, is almost 33% in the space. A very important player in the infrastructure space, in particular, which cement is very important. And so our efforts in saving AFRISAM have paid off because we are able to save thousands and thousands of jobs. Most importantly, saving an important player in the economy, and I can report that AFRISAM is back on its feet. It's performing exceptionally well so far. On the philosophy, maybe it will be appropriate for me to launch slide number 17. I think if you look at 17, it talks about social interest, rate of returns, and developmental investment that we've increased in that area to say we want to drive social impact as well get the returns. So if you look at the investment that we've made so far, they fit in that category quite well. you know, whether it's a renewable energy, whether it's in agriculture, we've seen very good returns for the kind of risk that we're taking. There's a product investment process that we follow within the organization. From, you know, the first time a proposal hits the doors of the PIC, how we go through it, how we process it, how we map the risk, and how we mitigate them. And then the different committees that are supposed to look at such an investment until approval is quite a robust process that we follow to ensure that whatever investment we make is able to produce the return as well as social impact. And we spoke about the JSC, the one that's sitting in the lower quadrant on the line there, to say very clearly about returns, returns, and we are now trying to push that to also deal with the social impact side of things. You know, there are lots of companies that are playing in the infrastructure space. There are a few companies that are playing in the agricultural space on the JSC, logistics, and so on and so forth, that have a huge impact on the economy. And we want to find a way of partnering with them. And the key word here is partnership, because we think if we partner with them, we bring the technical expertise that we acquire, we bring in the funding and the money that is required to kickstart projects. You know, so that is part of risk management. If you partner with an astute technical partner and you put in capital, then you think, I mean, in that way, at least your risks are minimized. I think if you go to slide 14 as well, so that we at least understand the new approach that we are not putting the line into, you know, unnecessary risk. You know, everything that we do, we will ensure that we comply with money parameters. The line sets the level of exposure, the level of risk tolerance. It will always define the mandate as how much we can take. And we will always operate within such parameters to ensure that we don't take unnecessary risks. That is very important. We don't have a leeway to do what we like. It must always be within the mandate parameters. And by the way, we are regulated by the FSB. All our client mandates are part of by the FSB. That is part of risk management, and that at least gives the client comfort that their funds will be managed properly. I think on the issue of e-culture, it's very important for the community to understand our activities. You know, we fund a number of state-owned entities. You know, for example, a Transnet. We have a number of Transnet funds. You know, that they will use their capital expenditure to make sure that they deliver on the projects that are necessary for the economy to grow. Sunrise, the same story, we have quite a number of bonds with them, and not necessarily for ETOLs. ETOLs is just one part of their activity. And we've given them bonds. They do quite a number of development of roads and so on in the economy. You know, so it hasn't been direct exposure into ETOLs, the bond that we have allocated to them. And these are big exposures. As part of the same story, even DBSA itself, we are allocating some money for them to be able to invest or help municipalities with service delivery and so on. So our activities in that space are pretty wide, you know. I think on GPS strategy, the spawns and the say in what we do. It's all about mandate, and they've given us a mandate. We report to them very often on our activities, on all investments that we do. So there's a fair amount of interaction between us, and not only the GPL and other clients as well. you know, so that we keep them informed, you know, about their portfolios, their exposure, the risks and so on that we are taking them into. So there's a fair amount of interaction that happens between us and the client to ensure that we don't expose them to unnecessary risks. I think the petroleum industry in Petro SA will fall within, if you go to the slide number 15 and 16 basically. I mean, if you go to 15, you know, we discussed the crude oil issue, but it's a big problem, you know, that the country is facing. And we need to find a way of, you know, slowly, you know, reducing this bill over time, you know. We don't necessarily have the product here, we source it elsewhere. And we can source it in the open market, or we can own producing oil wells out there. In other words, it's more mining versus exploration. So as part of the strategy, we've been looking for producing assets, you know, operating assets that are producing. And the attraction for us to invest in KMEC was basically for that reason, that they have an oil producing field as we speak. And there's a program to rent production to do that 17,000 barrels per day over time. KMEC is not going to be the only one. We are looking for other opportunities as well in the oil and gas space in order to deal with this issue of crude oil. I think we haven't been understood enough to take advantage years back to own some of the oil wells in Africa, for that matter. I mean, in Nigeria, you know, the western coast, we don't have any. And our view is that if we have quite a number of those, we'll be bringing oil, you know, at better prices and stabilize the petrol price at home here. So in the long run, we would like to identify such assets in order to reduce this exposure. So insofar as Mr. K. Sawan is concerned, we believe that he's no different from other investors out there, you know. If somebody brings to us a proposal that fits the mandate, that is in line with what we're trying to do, within acceptable parameters, you know, within the mandate, we're quite happy to invest in such. That is the basic principle. Chair, we also take to heart your comments about our branding, if I can put it bluntly, the issue of making efforts to educate the nation out there on our activities, and we are in the process of doing exactly that.
Chair, you know. Okay, I have a question. The last time you appeared in the committee, I think it was 2 years ago, and then the question is regarding the benefits and returns we have for members of the GPF. The one big strategy we have is that they not only enjoy benefits when they retire, but start enjoying benefits while they're still working. That's how you pick up in our business strategy, moving more into tangible assets, the hospitals, all those other things that allows them to enjoy the benefits while they're still members, not only upon retirement. So that is in our strategy, trying to make sure that we bring the benefits to the members closer. Maybe to cover up the question relating all the issues in the media. Most of all the issues in the media have always related to why have we invested in something. And if you would see most all the time, they respond to say our objective is to get returns, and to make sure that we are in line with the quadrant to show that on the sustainability and region. So that is an investment philosophy in how we decide an investment as Dr. Jenna Weber leadership to how it's that is being a philosophy in terms of everything that we do, which is governed by the mandate. So all the questions you see, it is that and approval, there's an approval process in terms of governance of the PIC. There's a delegation of authority and there's certain subcommittees that approve a certain amount. So each investment goes through the entire processes and checks that are required for every investment to take place in the due diligence. So that guides how we end up investing.
It's another one on the performance. I think the honorable member mentioned 9.42 as well as 31% for benchmark. We have to investigate that, but from what I see, it's probably in the new investment, because if they're in the unlisted space, most of the time the new investment that we do, there's a phase where there's more withdrawal. We commit cash, then they withdraw money for profit. So you go through what is known as the JKF, because the asset is not producing returns yet, but it's taking up cash into projects and so on. Then there'll come a time where the capital is fully invested, start to operate, and then start creating cash flow. At that point, we'll see positive returns. Excuse me. But in the nature of unlisted investment, that it takes a while, and especially when they're paying it. But we will fully investigate. Correctly.
Excuse me. There was a question about how the contraction in the economy has impacted on the PIC.
I think you will see that the equation about asset under management versus GDP is almost clear. When the economy is not growing, the assets suffer. But what is very interesting is that in this instance, throughout, we've seen a small negative growth, and some economists are saying probably in a recession and so on. But as an honorable member has highlighted, that there are other global forces at play here. What we've seen is that the JSE continue to be resilient under tough economic environment. We've seen the JSE hit new heights, driven by offshore investors looking for a yield. There's no yield out there. And that has, you know, impacted our portfolio in a positive way. We've seen good growth up to now in the current market environment, just because the JSE is running and it's almost 40% or 45% of our assets under management. That's how significant it is.
Yeah, I think more or less, yeah, I'll come back to you, Shimon. Just one little thing. As I understand it, the Deputy Minister of Finance is usually the chair of the PIC board, is that right?
Yeah.
So presumably we'll ask you to say something in a moment, right? We've got about 15 minutes left. Floyd?
Yeah, on the case that there was one,
it's cold in this room.
Yeah, it's cold in this room, says Sandy. When Sandy says it's cold, people are better at it. To your peril, otherwise. And here, this is the ANC coming to rescue the Parliament. Because that's the future of work for the ANC in the Parliament. Where's Peter Paul, by the way? Relevant to our commission. Okay, so like we can hear you despite the better Arctic weather.
I asked a question about the relationship of PIC to the industrial policy action plan. What is the relationship in terms of the areas that you focus on and everything? If there is no relationship, there's no problem. You can say that you don't have any relationship to the industrial policy action plan. And it will confirm any other observations that you have been making and people have been shouting it as you said.
Sure. How to say that? Hang on. Also, what you might want to answer is, why did you forget that question? let him die, that he's probably half right. So psychologically you're under the symptoms. But your head of your unit, the CIC, also wants to speak. So do you want to speak first, or the members speak first, or what?
If you looked at the slides, I mean, there was a slide that actually articulates very effectively the extent of involvement of PIC in the industrial space. We have started the process now as part of the strategic review now, where we are beginning to engage some of the critical players, including the PICC, around infrastructure and the priorities, and how we align those with the new structure that PIC is developing. We're also engaging DTI, particularly to look at those areas of EPUB and the industrialization strategy broadly, where we could actually easily increase our involvement and participation, so that we could actually spread growth in the sector. It's very clear, if you see, we've got a number of agriculture-based investments that have been made. It's very clear that agro-processing is going to be one of those areas where probably we might have to up our activities in line with what EPUB says. But also we're looking at others like beneficiation in the mining sector, etc. A lot of work already is happening. I know that in platinum and the beneficiation of platinum through different components of government, and we'll have to look at what exactly they are providing. So in a week or two, I know that we'll have a retreat just to actually firm up those engagements. And currently we far down the line in defining that. Can I also make a general comment again? These interactions are useful because I think, in a sense, you get out of this interaction with probably an understanding what people are saying and what people are expecting, but also to link it with what we're doing and maybe refine what we're doing and probably do it better. And I must say that this has been a very useful process. It's just a comment that has been made around it. But secondly, I think on investment strategy, you cannot, I think, you always have a very huge task of balancing the risks as well as ensuring that you drive development and you continue to stay growth in our economy in a very directive way, and also drive development broadly. And linking growth and development is probably one of the most challenging things that all of us are supposed to be faced with. And we already, if you really look at what has been happening in the new strategy emerging, that's exactly what we're trying to do. My last point, I think, is around communication and engagement with the public. I concur with you, sir. I think we've got a lot of work to do, and already I think the board is already experienced with that issue of explaining to the public some of the investment decisions, and with also, of course, bearing in mind the confidentiality that's supposed to accompany some of those decisions for investors, but explaining to the public some of the decisions that PIC is taking, and also ensuring that you enhance understanding of the role of PIC within the economy and public. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, John, Floyd, Marcosi, David, now. We've got exactly 5 minutes. Each of you can have 35 seconds.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll go as fast as I can. Now, let me have the deputy minister here. I'd like to know if I can get a better answer to my question as to what happened to Mr. Matilela and why he leave. Thank you.
So the enormous role that the PRC will be playing in terms of financing banks or recapitalization to a certain extent, as you've done with the DBSA, in terms of investment so that we can get the necessary progress there, that local government in terms of infrastructure. What's been your position in terms of the BRICS Bank? Have you been approached in terms of some format in terms of investment made into BRICS and some collaboration?
Right.
Yeah, the specific question I was asking was whether the fair, coordinated and clearly defined relationship between the PIC and the industrial police action plan, not the industry that you are financing. I understand that we're doing that and everything else. Most DSIs and all this, they do lots of uncoordinated work in terms of what happens. Whether that was Trump, the finance, biofuels, production, and other things. I wanted to check if there's a clearly defined relationship between the PIC and the DTI in terms of what happens. And then I asked the question as well with regards to what Green Wood said has been invested already with regards to mineral beneficiation. I said, what exactly are you doing where? What is happening with the mineral generation? All the limestone, that is what you mentioned there.
No, Chair, it has, it's just a short comment to say that I think we need as members to appreciate that PIC is also operating within constraints of the mandate of the client and also the FSC regulatory environment. There is so much you can do with pension fund money. There are things that are not allowed to do, and there are things that you can do. There is a certain amount that you can't invest, that you can't expose in risky assets and so forth. And I think that members need to appreciate that as well.
Okay, thank you. Over to you, Chris.
On a brief bank in particular, if you go to slide on asset allocation on offshore, I think it's number six. Inshore, this will fall under land domestic. We've identified the possibility of participating in Bridge Bank. We haven't been approached yet. Yes, we haven't been approached yet. So, but investing in Bridge itself is a strategy that comes quite attractive. You know, what is happening around this group of nations. So we'll look at it as part of our global mandate. So I think in terms of on the beneficiation part, we are looking at a number of projects. You know, some are still in their, you know, primary stages. There is a bit of way to go. For example, Fuerza, we've been looking at an opportunity there. It's not at a stage where we can say it's bankable. There's still a lot of work to be done to get there. And this would be designed to, you know, electrify remote rural areas because it comes with a unit and it's nice cell and so on, which can be utilized for that purpose. But the problem is that at this stage it's not economically viable. There's still a little bit of work to do. If you get it right, you can imagine sitting on almost 80% of platinum, what that can do. You know, there's that effort to ensure that we are not the part of our assets here or deposits that we have, you know. I guess in other areas like processing, I think the chairman has spoken and his assets, you know, are in line with what we're doing now. We are a big investor in, for example, Acre, you know. And the idea is to use the assets to directly drive agriculture and agro-processing with the kind of infrastructure that they have at the moment.
Okay. Maybe the question, Honorable Shivamba, for structure, is the structure, I mean, you've got the cabinet committees with DTI, treasury is engaging. There is a relationship, an ongoing relationship, structured relationship between IDC and PIC, as it were, to deal with the issues, etc. We are improving on that, and that's why we have started this consultative process, because we need to improve on that and ensure that it's well coordinated. A lot of work needs to be done. A lot of work needs to be put into that to get it functioning very well. So there's a lot of work. This is like work in progress. It's always a difficult thing. Somebody resigns and then you have to, and people have all sorts of reasons and they resign. And I think when a person resigns, the interviewer person is going for other things and et cetera, as he's employed elsewhere as we speak. And some cannot, sometimes there's always dissatisfaction. Why does a person resign, et cetera? It's almost like divorce. I mean, it's never like a sexual responsibility. So I take your point about maybe your misgivings about why persons resign, but the reality happens. People move to Glapastras all the time. He has resigned. I might satisfy you by saying he has resigned. It might satisfy you by giving reasons, I don't know. Clearly he has resigned and looking for other things to do in life. The coordination part, I want to emphasize, it's an ongoing work. I think that we must do. Coordination across government is a challenge that we are continuously dealing with. It's better than it was before, but I think it's work that we must continue to do to improve.
The norm in Parliament, as I know it, is if somebody resigns because they agreed a party, they sacrifice something. But if somebody resigns because of dissipation or disagreement with the policy, then it's correct for Parliament to ask without intruding on the right of privacy. Because there may be political decisions or policy decisions that he disagrees with. There are many organizations where people leave because actually the organization is not doing what it needs to do in terms of its legal mandate. That is why we ask.
Definitely,
it is acceptable to me, the committee chair, for now, but not in general. Then, you know, we must change the rules of Parliament, and we must become like the bondies of the executive. If I was sitting in your chair, Mr. Sheikh, I would not have. I would have given that answer and said, look, it's an acceptable answer. You know, this Parliament holds me to account. So, the same applies with whoever it is. We are comrades, but it's not an acceptable answer by any measure. You see, in the public domain, not that I was in this area, it was controversial. There were claims that he left because of certain decisions he took. Also, I think the ANC was thinking about it was too in its oversight role. There are many issues here that people are not picking up that are there in the public domain. What the PIC has been doing. So, I don't know. I will confer with the study group. So they'll guide me as a chair. But sitting here, there are many questions I have got that nobody seems to pick up on. And it's sometimes embarrassing that not an ANC member that picks up on. When we are supposed to, as the majority, to hold the executive to account. So I'll try to file a check. But we must ask if Parliament is fine. There are many, many issues that are not being raised here of the PIC that give you the newspapers on. Not my area. I didn't read the newspapers. And I can see there are many questions we are not asking, which I did want to ask, but I think we will have a study group to keep up. We have to put the issue on the agenda. Are we going to do what Parliament requires us in terms of the Constitution? Or are we going to be meek? That is a guideline you have to give me, because I don't feel that I should. There are a lot of things that are left out here. But having said that, somebody want to say something?
The issue of the relationship between IFAC and the PAC, I think we need to suggest that a presentation must be made about how exactly the FITS programs has been clustered together to deal with issues of industrialization. I think Honorable Shibambo might be happy with such a presentation. It's even so that, because he made a good point, he said there's no synchronization. Every GFI has its own approach in terms of issues of industrialization. So but it's not the GIC that will make it, that will be in that presentation, because it's an organization on its own that generally maybe the minister or somebody else from the department might want to make that presentation to our late phase. And then secondly, on the issue of the regulations, maybe so that we don't only rely on issues that are being raised in the public discourse, maybe we can formally ask the question so that at some point the PAC can be ready to respond to it so that it's not an issue that has been raised now and then they find themselves in a position where they don't know whether they should respond. Maybe we should formally pose it as an issue that we want to have and bring more information and facts that might be there in relation to the matter, and then it allows for further engagement. I don't know. That's what I
think. Yeah, I think we're seeking guidance. Do you have a lawyer in Japan? No. Well, we don't have a researcher. We have a researcher.
No.
Content advisor, we don't. I don't know how we're going to fulfill our oversight program. Let me make quite a point generally, but just mainly to the deputy minister, but also to you, Jesse. Firstly, a lot of what appears in the newspapers is just wrong. But a lot of it appears is actually. Now, it's probably just exactly what was said today, that he left for better. Maybe that's the case. I don't know. But the controversy in the media has to be managed appropriately by the PIC and or Treasury to disabuse the public that he left because he didn't agree with certain investment decisions you made. So I think the responsibility resides with the PIC and its politicized authority in terms of the Israelis. Did you tell that? It's not true. Maybe you're speaking from him also saying, look, it's not true, I just wanted to move on board, I got something more interesting. So it's useless. But over the last few years, there are many things that the PIC has done that in the public domain are subject of controversy. And when I say so, it's not that Democratic Alliance of Jews has been in existence. It's progressive people. It is a broad alliance movement that I come from, right, that bore me, that I am part of. Sections of the ANC, if you want to know, the Communist Party, the COSATU that are raising these issues. Right? And then when Dion raises it, then everybody starts saying, oh no, because the TA is raising it, we can't do it. I constantly, in the 20 years I've been in Parliament, go to the DNC, why don't you shut up? We're going to take up these issues anyway. Why don't you take it up? You know, everybody sees it, including myself, and we see it like that. But the DA has never learned that, right? So basically what I'm making is a more general point, which is, if the issue is in the public domain, and there's a reasonable legitimacy to it, then I think that the members of the committee are right to ask so that you have the opportunity in the first instance to clear the air, but in the second instance, we have a job to do. We are parliamentarians. We've discussed it already in our committee, that the more effective and rigorous for it, Deputy Minister, we are in our oversight, the better it is for you. So, I think that on the issue of Mr. Miller also like legal and other issues, you know, you can't do things in the public domain, but we would like to be assured that there wasn't any such thing, except that if it wasn't for many other cases of investment, which your organization has come to the public domain to question about, and let me repeat, not often little members of places, people within the movement itself that we come from, people on the right. So, I think that we ourselves will discuss what we want, what we mean by executive oversight and so on in a separate meeting. So I'm not saying anything untoward. I think PIC on the whole is doing a good job. You have an owner's responsibility, and as you implement the NDP, you'll be under greater scrutiny than ever. It's in your own interest to be more effective, more just more consistent with your mandate, and also the final question we have to put to you is, in a nutshell, what exactly do you want from us, so to speak? The job of Parliament isn't simply to hold the executive to account or its entities and say, you haven't done this, you haven't done that. It's just my job. Playing your role could have done any better. I'll probably do far worse. Okay, it's really different. The same thing. The question is, Parliament also should support and address you to the extent it's constitutional and legally tenable. So, what do you want from us? But secondly, how often do you think you should appear in this, before this committee? I'm not sure exactly what our role is in exercising oversight. Presumably you do an annual report, is that right? You submit that report like any other entity does. So we should be considering a report in the first instance. All committee members tell me it's not possible. You can't look at about 14 reports in the space of about 4 to 6 weeks, right? So what we could do, members, just think about this, is if we choose the committees and make them into categories. Category A committees we see every year. Category B committees we see every alternative. Category C committees we see once every 3 years. They're small and they're not really doing something that directly impinges on the mandate that National Treasury has for this come and we do as a committee of our program. Will members think about it? So we let them know. And then before you leave, there's a major issue. And we'd like Deputy Minister, where possible, we understand your main responsibility, to be here because you are the head, right? Yeah. Apart from the taxi and so on, you have to come back. And the PSC is here, we'd like you to be here, given its crucial role. So over to you, what do you think of what we said?
Well, I'm not respecting that. I'll come back to that. You start as official to the PSC, the ministry is new, but you've been here for a while.
I think the most important thing for me is that we've met today and we've taken quite a number of your comments to heart to shape what we're doing. As the chairman was saying, we have a retreat coming where we are going to put together.
One of the reasons on the agenda, put this out, engaging the portfolio position. Write up the one thing, two things, and every one other. What do you think, how do you think you can do the committee? What
do you think the committee can do to support your work? And how do you want to be held to to oversight by us? How about that? Okay. Deputy Minister?
That's fine.
That's cool. That's good. Thank you very much. Over to FIC. Thank you very much. Okay. On the FIC, they are a slightly sensitive organization. They also account to the... What's wrong? Don't be rude about it. What's wrong with that? Can you just tell me one again? Okay, let's start. Introduce yourselves kindly. Now, members, we have to take into account the slightly, let's put it this way, sensitive nature of their fight. They also have to gather to state security, that's correct? Right. And obviously we have to put questions to them about who investigated it and why, and did it reach to my friend. Okay, in the meanwhile, introduce yourself, why you've been set up by Alan. I mean, you did not know
him, eh?
Okay, you want to ask for
thank you. Chair, thank you very much. Let me start. My name is Marie Michelle. I'm the head of the FIC, and I'm accompanied by my colleagues on the FIC Executive Committee, Mr. Michelle Mewalol, who's in charge of the our monitoring and intelligence analysis section. Advocate Peter Smith, who's in charge of the legal and policy developments. Mr. Christopher Milan, who's in charge of the compliance domain. Mr. Michael Borg, who's in charge of the corporate services side of it. Shall I wait for the slides to come up? But thank you very much. There are hard copies available.
Yeah.
There we go. It's a warm tea. So I'm going to run through five key areas here. Background to our mandate, the operating model that we use, the architecture of the Act, and then the FIC functioning itself, and then certain of the risks that we are dealing with and facing at this point in time. There are a lot of slides. I'm going to try and be as quick as I can. I'm sure that suits everybody. The vision of the FIC is to ensure a safer future for all South Africans, which the financial system has integrity and transparency to support economic growth and social development. That's where we come from, that's why we report to the Minister of Finance, that's why we report to you, Chair, in this committee. And it's to promote increasing levels of compliance with the Act in an efficient, cost-effective manner, and provide high-quality, timely financial intelligence solutions to fight against crime, protection and national security. So there are two roles here. It's to ensure that the integrity and the system as a whole, and then as a byproduct almost, a set of data which we use in fight against crime and national security. And very, very quickly at a high level, this is all about anti-money laundering, combating a terror financing system. Money laundering, in essence, Chair, is the movement on and hiding of funds that are the proceeds of crime. In essence, that's what it is. And therefore, identifying that, making sure that our institutions are not abused by those who are looking to and seeking to hide those proceeds of crime. The legislative mandate, Chair, on slide 4, the FIC was established in 2001 and ended in 2008. And there are several legal mandates components to it. Identify proceeds of unlawful activities, combat money laundering activities, combat financing of terrorism and related activities, and booked into that is the issue of weapons of mass destruction, cooperate with law enforcement, cooperate with intelligence agencies, cooperate with other financial intelligence units in other parts of the world, supervise and enforce compliance with the Act. Those are all mandated areas of responsibility for us. The FIP Act works in conjunction with other related legislation, in particularly PORCA, the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, which in fact criminalizes money laundering, the POPTATARA, which is the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorism and Related Acts, and then the amended by African Police Act, which creates the DPCI, the FIC is a member of the DPCI, and in the National Strategic Intelligence Act, the FIC is a participant in the NICOP and intelligence structures. In summary then, the mandate is twofold, Chair. It's to produce information that makes the criminal justice system more effective, and at the same time to ensure effective compliance to protect the integrity of institutions. We seek to make the system as a whole, the financial system, a hostile environment to illicit activity, such as I said before, the high proceeds of crime or the funding of terror activities. And we seek to promote a high level of compliance with the Act in order to carry that through. Chair, overall, page to slide 6, the FIT contributes to the achievement of specific national priorities and outcome areas as articulated both through the NDP and through the medium-term strategic framework, particularly Government Outcome 3, where all people in South Africa are and feel safe, and Government Outcome 11, to create a better South Africa, a better Africa, and a better world. We operate in those two spaces, the law enforcement and intelligence on one hand, but there's a lot of interaction, I'm going to deal with that later on an international space, including on the continent and more close to home in the region. And in dealing with these two issues, we also indirectly contribute to outcome 4, consciously slow encouraging economic growth, investments, etc. Moving on to the next slide, 7 then. The FIC has 4 key strategic outcome areas as our primary focus. The first one is improving collection of information through the enforcement of compliance. The second one is the better use and utilization of the financial intelligence products from the FIC by the law enforcement and broad community. It's then, again, promoting the national interest in maintaining the integrity of the financial system, and then ensuring that we have a safe, secure, compliant, and efficient operating environment within the FIC itself in order to carry out our mandated responsibilities. Page 8 gives you, in a nutshell, the full operating model of the FIC. On the left-hand side of the slide, we deal with outcome areas, points to the National Development Plan operational focus, which is built around the national crime priorities and the national security priorities. The central panel will deal with the internal operating model, the cycle that we use in order to carry out our function. And then the right-hand side would be some of the deliverables and our relationship to our various partners. And this, in a nutshell, captures what I set up in the earlier slides. The operating model, Chair, has a number of different facets to it. We work very closely with the crime combating and security domains. The domestic structures that we work in and sit in and participate in, we're a member of the National Intelligence Coordinating Committee. We participate in the Justice Crime Prevention Security Cluster. We are a member of the Anti-Corruption Task Team, and we participate in the NAT joint structures whenever there are major events and issues that need large-scale coordination. Our domestic clients, who work with us but also receive our intelligence products, include STATS, the National Prosecuting Authority, in particular the Asset Forfeiture Unit within that, so we work closely with AFU, the Revenue Services, the State Security Agencies, and then various regulators as well, and there's a bunch of those we'll talk that through. And then there's the space, the international space that we work in with. Firstly, the FATF, which is an acronym for the Financial Action Task Force, which is an international standard-setting body. The Egmont Group is, like ourselves, a grouping of 147 financial intelligence units, in other words, representing 147 countries, and the ISAMLAG, which is an acronym for Eastern Southern African Anti-Money Laundering Group, which is essentially SADC plus a few others. So that's the space within which we function, operate, and carry out our mandate. The architecture can be summarized in slide 10, which gives you a sense of the FIC sitting at the center of a series of relationships. On the left-hand side of the slide, you have reporting institutions, which here is described as banks, but it's a whole range of different financial institutions and other businesses that are defined as being vulnerable to potential criminal abuse and money laundering. They're obliged to report to the FIC. There are different kinds of data which comes to the FIC. So-called cash threshold reports, CTRs, which are large transaction amounts. STRs, which are suspicious transaction reports. TPRs, property reports. And then EFTs, electronic fund transfers amounts, which can come across to the FIC. FIC receives this data, processes, analyzes it, makes sense of it, and then refers to the law enforcement and intelligence community. And as I've said before, previously, that community is made up of SAPS, DPCI within that, SSA, SARS. And there's also policy dimension where we would produce products for the Minister of Finance as well, insofar as that could be utilized for policy development. And then the relationship with other financial intelligence units, insofar as we need to either refer information to them or request information from them or them to us. And again, that sharing takes place under a series of very strict procedures and protocols. The compliance requirements which flow from that schema, that architecture which I presented to you, there are various categories of business that are required to comply. So first and foremost, obviously the banks, and they would provide the bulk of that of our data supply. The insurance industry, brokers, casinos, lawyers, estate agents will all fall within that, and all required to implement the FIC Act requirements and to then engage with the FIC. Now, amongst the obligations, all of those categories of businesses are required to report to the FIC, suspicious transactions, terror financing, etc., cross-border movement of funds, large cash transactions on both ways. So I've explained that already. They're also required to implement certain administrative requirements, keep record for 5 years, identify and verify the identity of their clients, appoint compliance officers, provide training for staff. Those are obligations. They have to do that, and they are monitored and audited for that. And finally, they have to register with the FIC as part of those obligations. So that's on the side of businesses. Supervisory body, there's a category of supervisory bodies, many of whom, or some of whom would be reporting to you, Chair, in this committee, who are obligated to oversee the monitoring of compliance of the FIC Act in their respective sectors, in their spheres of responsibility. So, for example, the Financial Services Board would oversee financial service providers, the South African Reserve Bank, both the Registrar and Banking Supervision Department, or the Financial Surveillance Department would be dealing with the banking sector. All of that, of course, is going to change once the Twin Peaks model takes effect. There'll be a reconfiguration of that. The State Agency Affairs Board, the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, Erber, who was here a couple of weeks ago, the National Gambling Board, the Provincial Gambling Boards, and the 4 Provincial Law Societies. These are all defined as supervisors. They all have an obligation to ensure that the FIC Act is complied with by businesses in those sectors. They're obliged to monitor the level of compliance, which they do through audits or inspections on site. And the FIC itself, ourselves, are required to supervise where there is no regulator or supervisor in place. So an example would be motor vehicle dealers. We'd be required to oversee that. Then we move over to the actual programs that the FIC itself runs in relation to the compliance program, the compliance domain. Mr. Malan, who runs this section, is responsible for compliance and supervisory relationship management, is responsible for dealing with institutions without a supervisory body. I said motor vehicle dealers, cruiser and dealers would be another area. And there are a range of different activities. The first would be to guide and advise supervisory bodies on their obligations, which would also include the issuance of guidance product, which interprets FIC Act. And there's a host of those that come out regularly. The idea is to raise levels of registration and to raise levels of reporting from those institutions so we have the data that we can then work with. Or the requirement to conduct tests and inspections to ensure compliance, and if necessary, impose various penalties and remedial action. So that's part of the compliance program. We have signed MOUs with all 19 supervisory bodies. We set out their responsibilities and obligations and what we expect from them and vice versa. We completed and conduct continuous awareness roadshows in the major centres, working with both accountable institutions as well as informing those supervisors who are in that area. And there's continuous registration with the FIC, increased 20% in the last year. Hopefully we'll get the entire universe of businesses that are required to register in soon. And then he's also responsible for running the enforcement forum, which is bringing together all the supervisors and making sure that there's a regular meeting, regular engagement, regular sharing information on the compliance side. Just a quick summary of some of the stats for last year. Public queries responded to nearly 16,000. Inspection conducted 159 by the FIC itself, many others conducted by the other supervisory bodies. Institutions registered last year nearly 4,500, compliance awareness session 45, articles published, guidance issued, the guidance products issued. That gives you a synopsis of some of those activities. We then move over to the law enforcement and relationship with the law enforcement authorities. And going back to the original architecture, just to give you a sense of what is required and what those obligations are in terms of the legislation. The idea behind this is that cases get investigated and prosecuted where proceeds of crime are generated. The law enforcement authorities receive referrals from the FIC, these are intelligent products. And it's not simply a case of dossier landing on a desk. There's an interaction and supportive action that accompanies that. So a lot of effort goes into multi-agency, multidisciplinary relationships to ensure that those referrals are acted upon. They're able to make requests to the FIC for additional information. So it's an element of reciprocity. They are required to appoint authorized officers. And the purpose of that is to protect the integrity of the information. I failed to mention at the onset, Chair, that the relationship of the FIC to businesses and to law enforcement is the FIC sits as an intermediary. And part of that is to make sure that the information that and the privacy issues involved in that information comes to the FIC and doesn't get passed on lock, stock and barrel to the investigators. It's kept in a safe space. Our responsibility is to make sure that that indeed is the case, and then manage those relationships. So the appointment of authorized officers by senior members of within the law enforcement community, be it commissioner, flats, intelligence and so on, is to make sure that any risk around the integrity of information is mitigated and managed. The relationship then also provides interaction between the FIC and various government databases to enable FIC to engage and develop the intelligence products it has. And then there's a requirement for ongoing interaction and feedback on investigations, prosecutions, and so on. And finally, they're required to collect our stats for us in relation to the number of investigations, number of prosecutions, stroke convictions. As mentioned earlier on, the key relationships that we would have on a continuous basis is as members of the